Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello and welcome. This is Dan Perkins with your America's Cannabis Conversation midweek update. Washington, D.C. DEA proposes interim rules that throw the CBD industry into legal jeopardy. On August 20, the Drug Enforcement Agency published its much-anticipated interim final rules regarding hemp production, regulation designed to put the agency in compliance with 2018 Farm Bill. Included in the IFR is a revision of the agency's definition of THC and marijuana extracts, along with the removal of FDA approval CBD-based medications from Schedule 5 listing. Significant controversy has arisen, however, over the DEA's interpretation of THC content as it relates to hemp cannabinoid processing. The definition of hemp does not automatically exempt any product derived from the hemp plant, regardless of the THC content. In order to meet the definition of hemp and thus qualify for exemption from Schedule 1, the derivative must not exceed 0.3% THC limit. While seemingly innocuous, the rule has drawn widespread criticism from CD processors that it effectively criminalizes the key parts of the CBD production process. To synthesize CBD or other cannabinoids from hemp, the hemp biomass must first go through an extraction process. And it is the process of extraction to take out the THC that gives problems to the industry who's concerned about criminal activity. Securities Exchange Commission. Disruptions from pandemic spur hemp companies to delay second quarter postings. August is typically the time of year when publicly traded U.S. companies file their financial results for the year's second quarter and year to date. However, as the COVID-19 pandemic spreads throughout the United States, companies in the hemp industry increasingly are seeking to file extensions to sort out their financial statements. In a survey of publicly traded companies, the Hemp-Based Journal found that 17 out of the 31 leading companies offering hemp and CBD products have delayed filings for the financial period ending June 30th. Sacramento, California. California must turn over marijuana documents to the DEA, federal court rules. A federal court has ruled that California regulators must comply with the Drug Enforcement Administration's subpoena demanding information about marijuana businesses. DEA initially asked for the unredacted documents concerning three licensed cannabis distributors and people associated with the business last year. But when officials with California Bureau of Cannabis Control didn't turn them over, the federal agency issued a subpoena in January. The state declined to comply, prompting the feds to take dispute to court. California officials argue that the DEA failed to adequately explain the relevance of the investigation, and providing the documents would violate state privacy laws. In response, the agency disclosed in a court filing last month that the materials were relevant to an ongoing investigation into possible illegal importation and transportation of marijuana oil from Mexico by certain licensees. U.S. Magistrate Judge Linda Lopez sided with the DEA on Monday, finding that the agency's subpoenas met the requirements for enforceable requests. The court finds that the United States has sufficiently established the relevance, met the not especially constraining standard, the judge wrote in her order. The court does not find that the subpoena is too indefinite or broad. Atlanta, Georgia. Patients want to talk marijuana with CDC during pain management meetings. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, recently announced it is hosting a series of conversations about alternatives to opioid-based pain medications, and a leading medical marijuana advocacy group is working to take advantage of the opportunity to educate the federal government about the benefits of cannabis. A staffer with the American for Safe Access recently submitted a request to the CDC to take part in one of the about 100 individual conversations the agency plans to hold about pain management issue with interested parties. These stakeholders include patients with acute or chronic pain, patients' family members and or caregivers, and healthcare providers who care for patients with pain conditions that can complicate pain management processes. The notice from the CDC states that the conversations will help inform the CDC and its understanding of stakeholders' values, preferences related to pain and pain management, and will complement CDC's ongoing work to update or expand the CDC guidelines for prescribing opioids for chronic pain. Our final story comes from New York City. A poll reveals which sports fans use marijuana and CBD the most and the least. Fans of esports like the UFC and racing are most likely to use marijuana or CBD, according to a survey released last Friday. The least cannabis-friendly sports fans are those who watch baseball, golf, and football. The poll conducted by Morning Consults breaks down how common cannabis consumption is among 14 groups of self-identified sports fans. For esports, 35% of the fans said that they smoke or ingest marijuana often or sometimes, while 29% said they use CBD products. By contrast, 20% of Major League Baseball fans said they consume marijuana, and 17% said they use CBD. The survey involved 1,269 U.S. participants and was conducted from August 13th to the 15th. Interesting, while golf enthusiasts among the least frequent cannabis consumers, the PGA is the one and only of two leagues that allow CBD sponsorship, according to Morning Consultants. The other is IndyCar Racing. That's your midweek update. I'm Dan Perkins for America's Cannabis Conversation. Join us this Saturday for our new show at 4:20 in the afternoon Eastern. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the conversation. And we have a fascinating guest who I've had a chance to talk to before the show a few days ago, Lisa Buffo. She happens to be the chairman of the Cannabis Marketing Association. But that's important. But what intrigued me is that she started in this business trimming buds. I think you said in 2014, is that right?
Yes, end of 2014, beginning 2015.
Yeah, yep. So she's come from the ground up. So Lisa, welcome to the show and to the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We talked about a lot of things we want to talk about, so let's get started. Tell us a little bit about our listeners, a little bit about yourself and about the Cannabis Marketing Association.
Yes, thank you. So I'm the founder and CEO of the Cannabis Marketing Association, and I am a marketer by training. My background is in working with startups, particularly tech startups, and helping them launch. Prior to joining the cannabis industry, I worked for a few different technology business accelerators and incubators that helped really early stage startups, you know, find their product market fit and launch and get off the ground with the goal of raising money and really scaling. And it was in those roles that I got the chance to work with dozens of early stage entrepreneurs and help put their marketing plans together, help them improve their social media presence, their online presence, and inbound marketing, and really fell in love with that niche and that sector. And then I moved out to Colorado in 2014 from Cleveland, Ohio, where I grew up and where I was living at the time, to join the cannabis industry. And I didn't know anybody out here at all. I didn't know anyone in the industry, but I really wanted to get my first, you know, hands-on experience working with the plant and with license holders. So I got my badge and started trimming, and that was my first experience really seeing a cultivation. And they were vertically integrated. They had a retail establishment attached to it. And working with the plant and seeing, you know, what it takes to get cannabis, you know, to in the hands of people. So that was sort of my start in the cannabis industry. And then I ended up working for a few different startups in marketing roles, most notably as the chief marketing officer for a company back in 2015. And it was in that role that I saw the need for community for marketers in the space. And so that's how I founded CMA. It was really first an informal grassroots group of folks, you know, just asking questions of each other. And I'd say, you know, hey, Dan, you're the marketing director of this brand. How did you pull off this campaign? Or, you know, what does this regulation mean? Or what did you do when you got your Instagram account shut down? And it was really just to help, you know, me and other colleagues learn about how to navigate marketing in this space, because at the time it was not a conversation the industry was having. And that's how CMA was started.
So, we talked to Lisa about marketing and the challenges of marketing today because of the strict federal regulations that influences what you can do even in a local market. So you're a groundbreaker again with the Cannabis Marketing Association. Who is your typical member?
So our typical member is generally the marketing director at a licensed business, and generally the smaller licensed business. So maybe they're a retailer that has one or two stores, or they're a brand that might be popular in their state. We do work with MSOs, and we do work with marketing agencies and service providers, but really our focus is the folks who are putting out marketing content on behalf of license holders. Most of them are generally in-house, but we also work with lots of agencies who have a portfolio of clients in the space.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, when we were talking before, we're talking about the challenges of marketing today in the cannabis space, given the pandemic and the restrictions on how product can be delivered. And I was talking to you about a gentleman I know in California who has 9 dispensaries, and he thinks that the next major important move in the cannabis industry is branding. And you and I talked a little bit about creating a brand. Why don't you tell our listeners in the conversation about the importance of establishing a brand?
Yeah, so, you know, cannabis is a commodity, and what we're seeing from the sales trends is that it's following that of consumer packaged goods as well. And consumer packaged goods, if you look at those companies in that space, they really focus a lot on their branding. And that is really the, you know, branding is really the emotional feel and connection that your customers have when they engage with and interact with your products. And it's becoming increasingly important in cannabis because the cannabis industry is also becoming increasingly more crowded. So how do you differentiate between, you know, brand A and brand B? You know, why should I buy one over the other? And really having a strong, cohesive brand is often what keeps customers loyal. And I also want to talk about branding and emphasize that it's not just the design. Some people think branding and they think, oh, you need a nice, pretty logo. I already have that. It's not just the design. Branding is also, you know, how are your customers interacting with you? What is the customer service experience like? Is the design and look and feel of your brand consistent, not just across your product, but social media and your website and every other touch point that your customers have? And we are seeing more and more sophisticated branding and marketing experts really putting out, you know, top-notch brands and content into this space. So in order to really stay competitive moving forward, cannabis businesses need to be thinking about their brand in order to convey the quality and, you know, what they love so much about their products that they produce.
You know, Lisa, in our pre-interview, you struck me with a very important message that I wanted to make sure we get on the conversation, and that is that while right now the marketplace is geographical within a state, that people who are in the cannabis business need to be thinking in terms of branding on a national basis and get ready for it now, because it's going to come sooner or later. But if it comes later and you're not prepared, you're going to be in deep trouble. Talk a little bit about your thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, this was really obvious, and I always find it really shocking when I talk with business owners who say, you know, I'm not going to plan or think about this until it happens. And to me, that's too late. You know, I've been working in this industry 6 years, and federal legalization has effectively always been on the horizon. You know, as soon as we saw Colorado and Washington and these states legalize in 2014, and then the subsequent domino effect that we have, you know, 30-something states now that have some form of medical or adult use laws on the book, and over 70% of the population is in favor, that it is going to happen. It's not a matter of if anymore, it's a matter of when. And I really think that if you're wanting to take, you know, bold steps with your business, you have to think boldly, and you have to sort of face this reality that you know, things are where they are now. We're all operating under this prohibition framework at the federal level, certainly, but it won't be that way forever. And if you wait until you get the green flag to plan for what that will look like, your well-planned and detailed competitor will beat you out. So I think it is something we can predict as far as that it's going to happen. We don't know what it will look like in terms of a rollout, but particularly with COVID, and I think states really hurting for money now, and you know, the conversations we're seeing in the news, that I really would not be surprised if this happens sooner than later.
You know, I've spoken to a senior person of one of the industry associations who was open with me that he was disappointed, and the industry association was disappointed that the Democrats took cannabis deregulation out of the platform, and they did it with like a 2-to-1 vote against it. So they're a little disheartened about it, but you're optimistic, and I agree with you. It isn't if, it's only a matter of time. One of the things that's going to happen, and I'd like your input on it, is that if we do get federal declassification, e-commerce is going to change this business rapidly. And Amazon may, in fact, be in the business to be able to sell cannabis products over the web. So e-commerce is going to be a very important strategy, and yet there are a lot of people who don't even pay attention to it.
Yes, that is true.
Or do you see it
coming
in the future?
Well, so to your earlier point, I also agree it is disappointing that cannabis hasn't been prioritized, but I do think there's going to be pressure as states need to find money to kind of get us through this. And it's just, to me, it's such an obvious win-win. So, you know, hopefully those things change. But yeah, as far as e-commerce goes, you know, I think we're going to have to see how it gets regulated and how it shakes out. If states choose not to do it that way, if the federal legislation, you know, allows it and under what conditions. But, I mean, cannabis more or less is one of the few, if not only, retail products that can't be bought online right now. And even so, that's a bit of a general statement because, you know, you can get delivery in places like California where it is an e-commerce experience. While it's being delivered and showing up at your house, you do have to, you know, purchase online, you know, kind of go through that checkout shopping experience. And, you know, in California, you don't necessarily have to walk into a dispensary. So we are already seeing it. And I do think cannabis is sort of a perfect product for e-commerce. You know, once you have found a brand and you like it and you've tried it and you trust it, there's no need necessarily to walk into a dispensary and compare, you know, once you've made that decision as a consumer. So I do think, again, it's another thing that just the cannabis industry is a startup industry with startup entrepreneurs, and we're currently just building the infrastructure for it. But to think it would look radically different than any other industry out there, to me, is short-sighted. We're just not fully there yet, but we are in those stages of building, both at the industry level and within individual businesses. So definitely something to consider and prepare for.
What's your thought about delivery service as far as expansion?
I think it makes perfect sense. You know, cannabis, it's a medical product for many. And a lot of the patients who use it are using it because they are in pain or unable to travel to a dispensary. So I think it is perfectly ripe to expand delivery services, and particularly in patients like Florida, where the population generally skews older. And, you know, we are seeing it instituted more and more. California has one of the more robust delivery, you know, programs. Colorado is starting to institute it here as well. So again, I think it's just a matter of time and how quickly kind of the state and the people can agree and get on board and make it happen.
Well, unfortunately, Lisa, we're out of time for this segment. Tell the people how they can reach you and your organization.
Yeah, so we are online at thecannabismarketingassociation.com. Our social media handles are at Canna Marketing, and you can find me as well at Libuff, Libuss, on Instagram, and would love to connect with any listeners, particularly marketers as well.
Thank you for joining us today, Lisa, and we'll have you back soon.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. It was my pleasure.
Okay. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is our new money person, Mike Regan, who's going to talk to us about a couple of things. I just wanted to remind the audience of some news that came out this week, and that was that Target had tremendous earnings and revenue. In fact, the biggest ever in the second quarter. And Apple became the first $2 trillion stock ever on any exchange anywhere in the world. And with that, I want to talk to Mike and talk about cannabis earnings. And last thing I saw, Mike, was that the industry was saying that they thought that revenues would be up 40% this year. So is that being demonstrated in earnings anywhere? What's going on with earnings in the first half of the year?
So for the cannabis companies, it's really bifurcated. There's essentially two broader markets you can look at. There's the Canadian-focused operators, and then there's also the operators that are more focused on the United States. So when I say Canadian, I mean the ones that operate in Canada, because most of them trade in Canada. It's about the operations. Basically, the Canadian operators, they've actually traded down on the second quarter earnings, whereas the U.S. operators have traded up, as they've essentially beaten estimates. Broadly, the Canadian ones are down about 8% on average since they've reported their second quarter earnings, while the American ones are up about 15% on average since they reported earnings. And this really just comes down to, you know, the revenue beats or lack thereof in Canada and the beats in the United States. And I think similar to Target, what we've seen is in the United States, you know, cannabis has been declared an essential service. People are continuing to consume cannabis, and the growth is incredibly strong, you know, despite COVID and the lockdowns and what have you, or perhaps because of it. That's up for debate, but the key takeaway is, you know, consumption is still up. I mean, even if you look in Colorado, which is commonly termed the mature quote-unquote market because it was the first to have recreational go legal, you know, the sales are up 20% year to date, and yeah, that's mature markets do not grow at 20%. So we've seen that reflected in the stock prices, where, you know, frankly, the American companies have stronger growth, and then also I think the optimism on legalization catalysts in Canada, the story is more, you know, the market is oversupplied. They're seeing price pressure, having to introduce value brands to compete with the illicit market and sort of right-size the cost structure on, you know, reducing production capacity or introducing new products. So that, you know, that story is less interesting to investors versus, increasing legalization, increasing consumption, and also increasing profitability. The American companies have proven that they can, yeah, that they're more profitable than the Canadian ones at this point.
Do you think that the Canadian market has reached a saturation point for the legal dispensaries?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more the market structure, because so stepping back within all cannabis, you basically have to look at the individual markets as their own micro markets, because there is sort of no broad cannabis market. In Canada specifically, you basically have a market that's about the size of California that is now federally legal with about, you know, the estimates vary, but it's roughly about 80% of the market is still the illicit market, i.e., you know, the illegal market, not through regulated dispensaries and such. And what the Canadian operators are facing is essentially a, you know, equal to superior product at lower prices and with better distribution, because there's been the dispensaries, which are in many provinces, you know, the opening of the dispensaries has been slower than some of the companies expected. You know, they have to basically wait for those dispensaries to open up. And on top of that, you had a lot of operators come in with lots of capital and basically build out too much grow capacity. I mean, depending on some of the numbers I've done, it's, you know, at one point it was about 2.5 times the market if you added up everybody's planned capacity expansion. So unless everyone in Canada started smoking twice as half, 2.5 times as much, this wasn't gonna work, right? So in Canada, the story is value pricing, lower prices to convert people from the illicit market to the legal market. And that's the right strategy, but from an investment standpoint, that's a tough, you know, investors are usually wary of pricing pressure, because if you don't cut the costs by a similar amount, your margins can get compressed.
Why is the government not pressing harder to interdict the illicit market in Canada?
I think, well, part of it is the, you know, when you decriminalize something, then it's easier to be in the illicit market versus when it's, you know, more criminalized in terms of that aspect. I think, I mean, in terms of specifically what the government's doing, they're, you know, it's they'd be wise to try to enforce more of the, you know, try to tamp down the illicit versus the, you know, versus the legal. But it also just at the end of the day comes to supply and demand, in terms of if the illicit market has as good, if not better product. And you're right that there's no regulation on it, but some of the product is perfectly fine. And it's lower cost because it doesn't have all the tax burden and, you know, corporate overhead burden. You know, people will buy what's good and cheaper at the end of the day.
There was a company that borrowed money to acquire Egg Harbor distributor or dispensary in New Jersey. And it was short-term financing, but they paid 60% interest. Did you see that story?
Are you referring to Acreage and the rated as annualized loan of, it was for 3 months, but it was annualized at 60%. Yeah, it was essentially,
right,
it was like a corporate version of a payday loan, essentially.
And was it, is it money that tight or that difficult to get that they had to pay those terms in order to get it done?
Capital has been tight in general in cannabis. That is by far the most extreme example that I have seen, you know, publicly and amongst the privates. That was more of a, I guess, a special situation on that specific loan. It was more, I think, looking less at the percentage rate and the, you know, we're paying X million. I think it would have worked out to a couple million dollars to secure the license. But capital's been tight, but not that tight. That was quite a surprising announcement to see that one. Most cannabis companies have had to borrow in more of the teens, which is still incredibly high.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But not
60. So we've been speaking with our new money guy, Mike Regan. Mike, how do people get a hold of you, follow you? Tell us how to do that.
The easiest way is to go to my website, mjresearchco.com. So mjresearchco.com. That's my website where I have, you know, links to other articles I've published on Marijuana Business Daily and other things I've published, and things I publish on my own as well. And then you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn through that website as well.
Thank you for joining us today, Mike, and we'll look forward to having you on again real soon. We'll be right back.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost one in five dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins, and we're about halfway through today's conversation. I hope you have found the people interesting and helpful. In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com after 5:20 p.m. to listen to this show. If you missed any of our previous shows, or you want to hear a particular show again, you can go to the archives and download a missed show anytime that's convenient for you. Our goal is to bring a high-quality program that is both entertaining and informative. Contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us is our cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. And we're going to talk a little bit about today, maybe my word, not Dr. Tischler's words, deception. People making outlandish promises about cannabis when it's not true or not proven. So welcome back to the conversation, doctor.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you again. And I don't think deception is a bad word, frankly, for what we're seeing. Know that it's as simple as not true, but I think your point about not proven is pretty spot on. And, you know, as we know, people who are sick, particularly quite direly sick where they might have cancer, you know, they're pretty desperate for a fix. It's a vulnerable position to be in, and I think that we've seen a number of groups ranging from, you know, individuals who've made a name for themselves on to various groups that have things to sell. They play on that, and that's unfortunate and I think inappropriate.
So let's talk about some of the misrepresentations about what cannabis can and can't do.
Yeah, you know, we talked in our previous show about all the things that cannabis can do in terms of symptom management, and to me, to my mind, that sort of thing is kind of a no-brainer. So when patients come to me and they say, "Doc, can you help me with my nausea, or can you help me with the pain I have?" That's not so controversial. Trust me, it's been controversial for a lot of my colleagues. But I think that the evidence we have now is pretty solid. But then there's this question of, you know, if I take a lot of cannabis in one way or another, can I make my cancer get better? Can I make it go away? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the internet at this point that says, well, you know, all you need to do to make your cancer go away is, you know, take a gram of hash every, you know, 4 hours or something like that. A gram of hash is just an outrageous amount of cannabis, not to mention very expensive. And every 4 hours is just, you know, that's the kind of thing where if I took grandma, who's never done cannabis anything in her life, and I gave her a gram of hash, she would be floored, like in bed, writhing out of her mind. You know, that is not what we want for grandma, right? That is not quality of life. You know, and yes, there are groups out there that say, well, you don't get to the gram of hash from the beginning. You start smaller and you work your way up. But even if you work your way up, we're still talking about an enormous amount of cannabis, which if we had solid evidence that this was the right idea and that it really were going to work, then we could work towards this in some measured fashion to get people to the point where they could tolerate that kind of a dose. But we don't know that that's the right idea. And in fact, the whole scientific idea that cannabis can kill cancer is actually very valid, but we don't have human data on this yet. So what we do have are some very interesting studies that look at human cells in a test tube, human cancer cells in a test tube. And when we add cannabis to the test tube, we can kill off a lot of those cells, which is really interesting. We also have to remember that, you know, if you put gasoline in that test tube, it would also kill them off. So it's not just as simple as say, look, we killed the cells. We have to know, you know, how much did we put in there? Did it kill the cells? Is it safe to give a human being those kinds of doses? And will it kill the cells in a person, not just in a test tube? And we don't have the answer to the latter set of those questions. One of the things that's very interesting is, our listeners probably know, cancer isn't just one thing, right? Not only is pancreatic cancer different from brain cancer, is different from lung cancer, but even within, say, lung cancer, there are various different types, and then you get into various genetic combinations and stuff like that. What's really interesting, some of the research that a friend of mine in Israel does, shows that not only are the types of cancer different, but their response to different types of cannabis would be different. And so you actually have to match the correct type of cancer with the correct type of cannabis in order for us to get the kind of response that we're seeing, at least in these test tubes. Ultimately, what this will mean is that we won't be thinking of them in terms of cannabis, as in, like, go to the store and buy some weed, but we will ultimately figure out what are the pieces, the chemical pieces that are in these cannabis extracts that are truly relevant versus which ones are just kind of along for the ride. And we may, in fact, then be able to develop drugs that are cannabis-inspired, perhaps, but ultimately are far more potent and far more specific to the cancers that we need to treat. All of that's going to take a bit of time for us to actually get to. And I think that's really where we are at this point.
How do we help people protect themselves from charlatans?
That's a good question. You know, I think that the reality here is that if you have cancer and you're really sick, you probably are going to do best with the advice of your physicians, right? And not all of your physicians are going to know much, if anything, about cannabis. And that's okay, because they know what they need to know to take care of your cancer. What they really need to have is an open mind, about what we can be doing in addition. And I find, at least here in the Northeast, that's not a big problem. That is to say, I think most physicians are willing to entertain the notion that they don't necessarily know enough about cannabis, they don't necessarily want to deal with the cannabis, but it may very well be helpful to their patients. And so long as their patients are being guided by somebody who does know what they're doing, somebody like myself or my colleagues, then they're okay with that. And so I think that my suggestion is, if you're thinking about cannabis and cancer, you should be looking for a cannabis specialist. You can go to the Association of Cannabis Specialists, which is a website, cannabis-specialist.org. We have a list there. And also, I do telemedicine consults for people who can't find somebody in their locality. So you can reach out to me at inhalemd.com, inhalemd.com. But I also think that you have to think long and hard about the fact that, at least for the tumor side of things, not so much for the symptoms we can take care of, but if your heart is set on the idea that somehow cannabis is going to make your cancer go away, I think you have to take a bit of a look at what we really know, which is too preliminary for those statements. And also, if people are advising you that it will do that, you really need to look long and hard at why they're giving you that advice. It may be that they have something to sell you. It may be that they're just overly enthusiastic. It may be that they share your sense of desperation, all of which are legitimate, or at least the desperation and the enthusiasm are legitimate, but may not actually be in your best interest. The way I deal with this in my clinics for my patients is that they say, look, you know what? We don't know enough to say that this is really going to help fix anything, right? So I say, look, keep doing the conventional treatment because that we do know works. We've put that through the rigorous testing. If we want to add cannabis, then we can do that. But we have to see it as an addition and not a substitute because we don't want to substitute something that is unproven in the place of something that has been proven. That would be shooting yourself in the foot.
So are you saying, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, doctor, but are you saying that we have a better body of evidence on treating the symptoms of the cannabis or the cancer and perhaps side effects of some of the medications that are used? We have better research on that than we do on the curative power of cannabis.
Absolutely. That's exactly spot on. It doesn't mean that cannabis doesn't have curative powers. It doesn't mean that we won't get that evidence. It just means that here as of, you know, whatever it is, February 10th, 2020, we have a lot of information about how to treat those symptoms. And we're just sort of starting the beginning of the process of looking at whether cannabis can actually treat the cancer itself.
In the moment or so we have left, I want to ask you one final question. Again, not intentionally trying to put you on the spot, but sort of, I guess. What are the medical schools today doing about educating their medical students about the opportunities with using cannabis in their practice?
That's a good question. I don't feel on the spot, but I will tell you that the answer is not enough. You know, I'm associated with Harvard Medical School, where over 2 years ago, closing in on 3 years ago, I proposed an elective course for medical students, meaning not they didn't have to come, but if they were interested, they could come and spend some time with me in the office. And I got shut down. And I finally got the final word on that just a couple weeks ago. It wasn't even like the committee said, well, we're not so sure. Why don't you come in and we'll talk about it and we can see what, you know, they basically just wouldn't even respond to me. Finally, I went to a friend of mine who's one of the deans and said, what's going on here? And he said, I don't know, but you've barked up this tree long enough. So, you know, I find that sort of upsetting. Given the amount of research, given the fact that I wasn't asking for them to force their students to listen to me, but rather just to give them the opportunity to come and learn something, there's definitely some room to be made. You know, we have some mileage to go in that educational arena. There are probably schools out there that are a little bit more forward-thinking than my particular institution, which is a thought that upsets me. But it's probably reality. I mean, God knows the guys at UCLA may not be teaching their med students, but at least they're doing a ton of research on the subject, and hopefully that all sort of somehow trickles into the curriculum over time.
Wonderful. Thank you for a fascinating conversation about an important issue of cancer and cancer treatments and fakes and foils and bad things that go bump in the night when they're not real. We've been talking with Dr. Jordan Tischler. He was our America's Cannabis Conversation doctor on call. Jordan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest-growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Joining the conversation today is a gentleman we've had on the program several times, Nick Richards, who is an attorney and a former IRS attorney, and he's now with the firm of Greenspoon and Martyr. And we're going to talk about the industry and what it might look like going out the other side, and what is his law practice going to look like going out the other side. So welcome to the conversation, Nick.
Thank you, Dan, for having me on your show.
There's a lot of people already beginning to start. It's interesting to see that we've come through this sequester, I think, amazingly well. But there are more and more people, media types and business people like me and you, who are beginning to ask the question, okay, when are we going to get back to try and get back to some degree of normal? And so a lot of people are I read recently an article, you should be using this downtime to begin to plan what you're going to do when you come out the other side. What do you think the outcome is likely to be on the other side?
I saw some news last night that, you know, we're not going to return to, where we were just before the coronavirus came out. We're going to be involved in this for quite a while, and it's going to change the structure of society. For me and my tax practice, the IRS is sort of taking a back seat now and giving people space and not requiring that returns be filed for 90 days and giving a break on making tax payments, and then also holding off on what's called enforced collection. So people with pre-existing tax debt, the IRS is taking a very gentle hand with those folks. I actually spoke mm-hmm. to an IRS revenue officer manager. The revenue officers are the ones that collect the money. And the manager told me that they are being told to exercise extreme caution before using any of their collection tools, and that would include liens and levies. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened in the Great Recession. The IRS sort of, took a back seat for a while, and a lot of people sort of forgot about their tax obligations during that time. And then when everybody got back up to speed, they said, now what do? I haven't filed tax returns and paid taxes in 3 years, and et cetera, et cetera. And so we sort of had a lull in my work, and then it came roaring back when the economy came back. Mm-hmm. One thing also that happens during these times is the IRS. Most of your listeners have probably seen those and heard those commercials, settle your taxes for pennies on the dollar. And mm-hmm. those are called offers and compromise. And offers and compromise get easier when the economy gets worse. And so there could be an opportunity to get an offer and compromise in place where previously the IRS would not accept one because of where the economy is now.
Okay, so you're looking for some increase in activity in your practice. I understand what you're saying about whether or not we'll ever go back to what we were, and I don't think we could ever go back to what we were. I want to think that we've hopefully learned some things about ourselves as individuals and as a nation, what's important to us, and we may come out of this much better. I do think that there is, as I agree with the president, there is a daily increasing pent-up demand. I mean, I look at what's happened. My wife and I are here in Sanibel, and all the restaurants are closed. The movie theaters are closed. We're not spending much money. I mean, we're not that we're hoarders, but we don't overspend at the grocery store. We try and manage our food as best we can. And, we're doing streaming and playing games and watching 1,000 different miniseries on Netflix and Amazon Prime. We also use our iPhones to communicate to our children and grandchildren with conference calls and little games we play. So I'm thinking, and maybe I'm somewhat Pollyannish, that we're going to be a better country after this. I do question that perhaps maybe we've gone too far, but that's for a different program, a different subject matter. It appears that with at least the medical, since the government has decided that medical marijuana facilities are critical, do you get any anecdotal information whether volumes are holding, going down, going up, any sense of what's happening on the medical space?
Yeah, I think that there was a big rush to get out and get a good supply when, many states were first announcing the stay-at-home orders. I'm not sure if that has continued or not. I believe that, critical companies are enjoying pretty robust sales. But after that initial rush to, get your $99 ounce or what have you, how much more do you need, and what happens, and can those companies provide their product to their customers if they have to maintain social distancing and all that other kind of stuff at their facility?
Yeah, I'm curious because when we first got involved here, we were talking about 2 weeks, and then the president extended to another 30 days, so that the supply chain under the cannabis space may have been disrupted because if you were buying for the 2 weeks, that's one thing. But now you've got another 30 days where it's, going out and going to the dispensary. And as you said, with the social distancing makes it very difficult to see what's going on. And I'm just curious as to whether or not we're going to have a different attitude. I know we had on our show a couple of weeks ago, our cannabis doctor on call, and we spent a whole segment on dealing with how the coronavirus 19 is affecting anxiety and depression in the country for a lot of people, and that cannabis can be a big help. So that having the medical places stay open creates an opportunity. But I would assume that your physical office practice has pretty much collapsed or not?
Yeah, so I, I've been working from home and trying to deal, it's interesting to see what's happening to the internet now that everybody's working from home. It's not nearly as good as it was.
Right.
And, I try to, I have, legal filings I have to make. And so that sometimes requires that I go into the office. So I went into the office on Saturday, actually, and prepared a bunch of documents to get mailed out by my staff while no one was there, and then went back home. So I've been trying to avoid having to go out to the office. I'm not, I'm not a critical employee as far as our state has announced. In the first round, law firms were critical, and then in the second round, they were not. My wife doesn't want me to go out at all. So, I'm not in the high risk category, but I'm 54. And so, I'm taking it very seriously, Dan.
Oh yeah. Well, my wife and I are in our mid 70s, and I have a diabetic problem and she has a breathing problem, so that we're very, very conscious of where we go and when we go and how often we go out. I wonder, your law firm, is it a general practice with some specialty in cannabis, or is cannabis a big part of your firm's business?
Yeah, so we're a general practice firm. We have 26 offices across the country, including here in Denver. And so we provide any kind of legal services in really any state in the country. And then we have a strong cannabis practice because of several individuals, myself included, who are somewhat trailblazers for the cannabis industry, our partners in the firm, including my partner Rachel Gillette, who was a big promoter of legalized cannabis here in Colorado when it very first passed. She was the president of a group called Normal at the time, and so she's a big player in the industry. And then our named partner, Jerry Greenspoon, is also a big player in the industry as well. So we've got some real talent in the cannabis world. my practice is, I'm a tax problem guy, and so I've handled tax problems, be it audits and trials and debt, for any kind of company and individual, I was with the IRS for 10 years, and then I've been on my own for about 10 years. And then because the cannabis company has such a big tax problem, that's become a big part of my work. And that problem just seems to be increasing.
Yeah.
And the IRS is taking a real targeted approach to dealing with the cannabis industry. And, you know, it's the word on the street is if you're in the cannabis industry, you should expect to get audited. And you need to conduct your affairs, expecting that at some point you'll have to prove them.
Something that you and I talked about on a previous show, and that is the unique problem for bankruptcy for somebody in the cannabis industry.
It's related to a code section, Internal Revenue Code Section 280E, disallows deductions for the cannabis industry. So they cannot take their business deductions. And because they can't take their business deductions, that creates what's called phantom income. And phantom income means you get taxed on income that you don't really get. And so the IRS has taken a hard hand in enforcing that 280E section. And the bankruptcy courts have seen the bankruptcy as sort of an end run around 280E. And for that reason, they have said that cannabis companies do not qualify for bankruptcy relief because it would be an end run around 280E, and they are federally illegal, and bankruptcy is a federal protection. Now, that was a Ninth Circuit case that said that, limited to the Ninth Circuit. I'm not a bankruptcy attorney. Some of the bankruptcy attorneys that I've talked to have said that they think that's incorrect, and it will come out differently in the next case, but we haven't seen it yet.
I've been told that if you're not structured properly, meaning I've heard limited liability companies create a problem that you can't really file for bankruptcy, in addition to the 280E situation, where S corporations and C corporations might be. But are you expecting a raft of bankruptcies out of the cannabis industry after we come out on the other side?
No, I'm not, because I think the courts are generally saying that cannabis companies don't qualify for bankruptcy relief. Dan, let me say one thing. Limited liability companies are a problem, not because they are more or less qualified for bankruptcy relief, but because if you're in an LLC or an S corp, those are what are called flow through entities. And you basically, the taxes of that company are reported on your personal return, your Form 1040. And what that means is that phantom income that Section 280E creates, that phantom income becomes your personal income. And so that now, because it's your personal income, you don't get it, but you still get the tax on it at personal income rates, which are higher than corporate rates. And if your business fails, cannabis industry is a very risky industry. If your business fails, you just lost your company, but if you're in a flow-through, you get to keep your tax liability because it's not your company's liability, it's your liability.
Whoa.
Differently, wow. if you're in a C-corp, and only a C-corp, not an S-corp, but if you're in a C-corp and that C-corp has a tax liability and that company dies, you are not personally liable for that taxes. And so the tax liability can die with the company. Now, a couple caveats there that anyone who's going down that road needs to understand, but generally you can get out of from underneath those taxes in a C corp where you can't do that in an S corp or an LLC.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time again. We've been speaking with Nick Richards, our tax guy and lawyer. He's with Greenspoon and Marker. How do people get a hold of you, sir?
Pleasure to talk to you. My phone number is 720-370-1169. And my email is nick.richards@gmlaw.com. That's nick.richards@gmlaw.com.
Thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.